The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, last week we had a show that was posted hours before this huge swap line infusion of currency over in Europe saved the day. But I mean, the reports came out afterwards saying that banks were going to fail literally hours after we had recorded that program had that not have occurred.
Kevin, I've looked all over for an increase in credit default swap spreads with individual institutions, and I still can't figure out which bank it would have been, whether it was a German or a French bank, but right. The single line item in the Fed balance sheet, which is usually for pocket change, the kind of thing that you would have as a petty cash account in your company, expands from literally a couple million dollars to $88 billion. That was sort of a first clue early in the week that somebody needed some kind of cash, and they didn't want to really draw attention to the fact that they were active in the markets in a bailout scheme.
So, well, and David, that miscellaneous account at the Federal Reserve is really treated as petty cash. I mean, we've talked about it before. It's like having a box with a few hundred dollars in it that you buy pizza with. And $88 billion all of a sudden showed up. We talked about this before, but we're seeing huge amounts of money disappear and no one really wanting to talk about it. Like you had said, was it a French bank? Was it a German bank? We don't know who was saved, but we know a lot of money was provided.
Well, in just giving you some concept of what it was within the first 24 hours of these funds being made available by six different central banks, this gives a whole new definition to the idea of 357. 357 billion euros is going someplace in order to keep the gears churning and to keep there from being a freeze-up in the banking system within Europe.
Well, now, and David, you've pointed out that this is just a temporary solution. This is papering over a problem that we discussed, and for the listener who wants to really understand the problem, they should listen to last week's program, because you had terror in your voice. You're normally a calm guy, but you had this look in your face like, unless something's done almost immediately, we're going to see a major failure over on the European side.
I have mixed feelings because, on the one hand, something was done immediately,
right.
But I don't think that it actually is a solution. But here's what's at issue, Kevin. At issue is the European bank debts, which, and we're talking about commercial institutions here.
Right.
These institutions have over $2 trillion, which they need to be rolling over. So these are loans that they have outstanding, debts that they owe out to other people, other institutions. They have to roll that over between now and the end of the year.
Yeah.
So, and these are denominated in dollars. So U.S. money market funds, as we made mention last week,
right.
They've been willing to loan money to these banks. Kevin, essentially these banks have been funding themselves with inexpensive money provided to them by U.S. and global money market funds.
And when you're talking about these banks, you're not talking about the ECB in particular. You're talking about the banks that answer to the ECB or borrow.
Exactly. That could be Societe Generale. That could be BNP Paribas. That could be Deutsche Bank. That could be Banco Bilbao. Whether it's Spanish, Italian, all of them are funding themselves to some degree with short-term money. And this money, a lot of it has come from the U.S. in the form of money market deposits. So U.S. investors place money with their brokerage firms into a quote-unquote cash equivalent, where their assumption is that they can never break the buck. And what we saw a few weeks ago was U.S. investors probably making lots and lots of calls to their money market managers saying, I hope you don't have exposure to European paper. And there was enough of an outcry that, guess what? Those money market funds said, okay, we're done for the time being. We'll see you. We'll be back, but not for now. And that created a rollover crisis for these banks who are reliant on short-term paper.
So,
again, in the form of commercial paper or repurchase agreements.
So the Federal Reserve and five other central banks basically stepped in and filled that void. I'm part of that, Dave. I mean, let's look at what this is. We've talked about this before. You continue to print money. You continue to keep interest rates unnaturally low. What you're basically doing is diluting the buying power of the American public now to bail out Europe, okay? It's just another form of easy money, is it not?
It is a form of easy money, and I think this is what's interesting, because if European banks had to raise that money privately instead of through the central bank, that the collateral would be significant. Something would have to be pledged. You'd have an interested party on the other side wanting to know if there was a real value that could be assessed to the collateral that you were pledging. And this is really the problem. It's why the ECB has to be involved, why the ECB is the conduit for these other central banks and the liquidity that's being provided, because the ECB is really willing to turn a blind eye to the value of the collateral offered by these banks.
Well, this sounds a little bit like here on this shore when we had the real estate bailout. All of a sudden, the collateral doesn't match what the bailout is.
Well, that's exactly right, Kevin. Good recall. Maiden Lane 1, Maiden Lane 2, that's where toxic paper went on to the New York Fed balance sheet and treasuries were issued in response. So kind of a swap transaction where, okay, you need liquidity, you need something better. What we're going to do is just an even exchange, if you will. We'll take the toxic, you take the good. We have time on our side as the Fed, quote unquote, to allow these assets to go back to normal value. You don't want to sell them in a distressed period in time. We'll just let them return to full value and we'll recapture that and maybe even have a profit at the end of the day. That's the stopgap measure we had with Maiden Lane 1 and Maiden Lane 2, and that's what we have right now is a stopgap issue. It solves liquidity crises in the moment, but it does not solve the debt crises and the solvency issues which remain.
Well, and I think you've mentioned in the past that it solves the problem maybe for 7 days at a time. So in other words, we have maybe a 7-day reprieve and then another 7-day reprieve. We talked last week about the 13 days of Christmas, the critical days in the fate of the European Union. And it has to do with this $2 trillion
well,
that you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about that because on the one hand, you've got private institutions or publicly traded institutions, if you will, but you're talking about commercial enterprises, banks that have to roll over $2 trillion worth of short-term loans, and that's now running in direct competition with the funding needs of central banks throughout Europe who have close to $100, $120 billion, and that's what we were talking about last week with the 12 and 13 days of, and it's actually more than that, days of Christmas.
Right.
But we're talking about a competition in the debt markets for a scarce resource. That scarce resource is money.
There's old borrowing and there's new borrowing. What you're talking about is old borrowing is needing to roll over and new borrowing needs to still come into the market.
That's exactly right, in order to finance current budgetary requirements by these particular governments. So the Financial Times ran an article last week, Kevin. Our guest, Otmar Issing, was the author, and it was a fantastic piece. He basically says the ECB's bond buying is unacceptable. To offer to buy an unlimited amount of bond, and let's be clear on this, what happened last week was not ECB bond buying.
Right.
That's not his point of concern. We're now talking about just the unlimited purchases, direct purchases of bonds, which the ECB has done already to the tune of 200 billion euros.
But they haven't officially said that that's what they're going to do. They still say, well, we don't do that.
Well, and what they've said, like most central banking measures, is this is short-term and limited in scope.
Right.
And so the unlimited promise of bond buying, that's what Issing is particularly critical of, because he goes back to the classic Walter Bagehot book, Lombard Street, written back in 1897, and he says this is the advice that needs to be taken, sage advice that's not being taken by central bankers today. And I'll just quote from Bagehot. First, that these loans should only be made at a very high rate of interest.
Right, to punish.
This will operate as a heavy fine on unreasonable timidity and will prevent the greatest number of applications by persons who do not require it. So, in other words, that was the bar set. You had to do it at some sort of a penalty rate.
Right.
There had to be an interest rate that was unattractive, even though this loan was necessary. Otherwise, everybody and their brother stands in line for free money. The second point that Bagehot made was, secondly, and I quote, that at this rate, these advances should be made on all good banking securities and as largely as the public asked for them. So in other words, you know, we're talking about collateral that is pristine. We want your best pledged security. So,
right.
Kevin, let's say you want to borrow $100,000 from me,
right,
and you're willing to put up some collateral. And you could, say, put up the...
How about a mule in my best blanket?
Yeah, well, that or, you know, some sort of a deed for your house.
Right.
You know, that gets a little uncomfortable for you because, you know, then you've got family issues if you should ever have to have a capital call or a margin call where I come in and take your house.
Right.
My personal preference would be if you're going to borrow $100,000 from me that you put up $50,000 to $75,000 in gold.
Right.
That to me is pristine collateral. I know exactly what I have and I'm giving you a reasonable sort of loan to value ratio and I feel like I'm reasonably covered. You've got a lot of skin in the game and this is a real asset.
Right. But what you're basically saying is Issing is saying we don't want to have unsecured debt going out. That seems to be happening right now.
And we don't want to see, he would be saying, we don't want to see the ECB become the repository for a bunch of crap.
Right.
I mean, and where it just becomes a dumping field for anyone with garbage paper. That's a problem. That's what the Fed did with Maiden Lane 1 and 2, and I think he's very wise to say, hey, wait a minute, the ECB is different. The ECB has to be different, and of course this exposes his Bundesbank conservatism. He does believe that it should be at a penalty rate and that the collateral should be pristine. Those two qualifications thus far have not been included, and he's saying it would be an utter disaster to continue as we have been, and if you make it an unlimited promise, then you're looking at the end of the ECB's credibility.
Do you think maybe he was writing this article in response to a concern with the new Mario Draghi regime basically running the ECB?
Well, I think absolutely, because what he's already seen is the promise of short-term and limited, and those are Draghi's actual words.
Sure, short-term and limited, a little bit like short-term taking us off the gold standard in 1971, short-term occupation of Spain by the Muslims.
It lasted for 700 years, and they were actually brought in. I mean, they were invited in.
Right.
You know, North Africa, you have major political issues in Spain at the time, and they were invited in to bring stability. A general from North Africa is brought in, and he says, okay, we'll come, happy to be here. Only be here temporarily. Now, the first clue should have been he burned the boat. And I feel like all of your world central bankers have said, okay, short term, limited. And we should all be noting that they're burning the boats. They're here to stay.
So when the family comes over for Thanksgiving and then stays till Christmas and then stays until Easter, maybe that's no longer temporary. And so Draghi is basically saying, oh, yeah, we're just going to do this temporarily.
Well, I just want to quote from the Issing article in the Financial Times. They did a great job putting that in there. As Issing says, you're transferring an obligation of public finance into a monetary phenomenon. And then he goes on to say, stressing the role of the central bank as the ultimate buyer of public debt should be seen as an indication of the pathological state of public finances, not as a sign of strength. So again, it's this issue of when the ECB makes an infinite promise, you should not see that as stabilizing. You should see that as a sign of pathology.
Right.
Boy, he's got that nailed.
And David, for people who are not familiar with European central banker speak, because Issing is very eloquent and careful in what he says, what he's actually talking about is you're transferring this problem, this crap public debt, into pure inflation. I'm just trying to cut to the chase, because that's what it would be if it's not temporary. They're going to print the money. They're going to lower the interest rates. It's going to turn into exactly what the Germans said they never, ever wanted again.
This is the point that he is very sensitive to. He realizes that a central bank creating money is doing that dependent on one variable, credibility. Credibility is key. If your actions at any time create, even on an unintended basis, the consequence of a loss of credibility, then you, as a central banker, are out of a job.
Right.
And can't fulfill a function that, by a central banker's own admission, is absolutely necessary. We would say, maybe not necessary, but again, if credibility is the key, then don't do stupid things to eliminate that credibility.
Well, David, let's go back and see if what they did at least did temporarily work, because we talked last week about Spanish bonds and Italian bonds, especially the Italian bond auction, needing to succeed. Well, it did.
And you're talking about the coordinated effort last week by 5-6 different central banks funneling money through the ECB to the banking industry.
Yeah, but the Spanish got to sell their bonds. The Italians got to sell their bonds.
Exactly. The yields came back under 7%. French paper was fully subscribed at reasonable rates as well. You had Spanish bonds, which immediately thereafter, actually, the rates on Spanish bonds were the highest they've been, but they were oversubscribed. So the demand for those bonds was twice the paper on offer, which, you know, again, it had a quote-unquote stabilizing impact in the immediate.
Well, let's face it, Dave. If you knew you were going to get paid on those Spanish bonds and they were offering 7%, you know, or Italian bonds or what have you, forget the fact that they're from Spain or Italy or bankrupt countries. What we're basically saying is it's got the full faith and credit of the United States government behind it at this point.
We've got 6 central banks backing up the ECB. Well, 5, I guess, and then the ECB as well. So 6 total in the mix. That's a lot of credibility. Now, guess what? That's also a lot of credibility to lose if this begins to fade. We see that the actions did, in fact, relieve the immediate funding pressure. It provided liquidity from these foreign central banks to the ECB for further disbursement to the European banks. At the end of the day, Kevin, it's just a stopgap measure. And yes, it was needed as the private sources of short-term funding were drying up. But money market managers here in the U.S., for the first time in a long time, were finally engaged with these issues. We explored some of the money market funds that we're familiar with and have used. And fortunately, the ones that we have used They were engaged with this process 18 months ago.
So they had already stepped away.
Yeah, not 18 days ago when there's an uproar from the crowd saying, I think this is going to be a problem. They were thinking ahead of it, and they've been eliminating exposure to European banks all along.
And talking about thinking ahead, one of the things that we've criticized, Dave, over the last few years is, you know, S&P and Moody's and Fitch and these guys who are looking at problems and ignoring them because of old models. Okay, now S&P downgraded last week, a number of institutions, did they not, saying that it's now time to look at risk in a different way.
Right. Now they're looking at country-specific elements and funding-specific elements within specific countries, if that makes sense,
right,
that would impact the funding of these large financial institutions. These are very relevant risk factors, and on that basis, they downgraded 37 of the world's largest financial institutions in a single week. I mean, last week, we're talking fireworks. This is fantastic. I mean, as a student of financial history, it's not going to get any more interesting than what we had in real time last week. Perhaps until next week.
Well, David, we talk about countries. Okay, we even talk about large blocks of countries like the European Union. And then we talk about states, and we've talked about municipal bonds. We don't get too often into the individual category, though. Let's say that S&P was actually looking at the finances of someone who's, you know, in their teens or in their 20s, these young households right now here in America. What kind of credit rating would they get?
They wouldn't get a very good rating, you know, and this is not just a basis of not having any exposure to the credit markets, no record to base it on, a track record, so to say. Kevin, let's look forward to what happens in the stock market over the next 2, 3, 4 years. What happens with earnings? What happens to profit margins with individual companies within the United States and around the globe on a couple of demographic variables? And then that's really what you were raising, is the issue of a young up-and-coming generation that is not going to have the same wherewithal,
right,
that previous generations had. And that wherewithal comes from several sources. As we've talked about in last year's DVD, there was the element of a decrease in savings. You know, there was an average of about 10 or 12% annual savings in the U.S. between 1966 and 1982. And what fueled the equity bull market from 82 to 2000 was two primary variables. One was a decrease in savings from that 10 to 12% on average to zero.
Right.
So you're spending instead of setting aside, and in fact, you're spending through your savings as well. So going back and dipping into the bank account to go ahead and enjoy the here and now. In addition to that, you had an increase in credit. So people were actually going into debt to consume yet even more. So,
well, that was the cycle where interest rates were falling all the way through that period of time. You've brought out the fact that it's been about a 30-year dropping interest rate cycle.
There's a vast difference between sort of the household wealth of the over 65 set versus someone under 35. And this is really critical. We talked about this several weeks ago, contrasting the over 65 set and the under 35 set just in terms of net worth.
Right.
The net worth used to be, back in the 80s, about a 10 times differential. And you'd expect that. Somebody's 30 years on in their professional career, they've been able to buy assets and see them expand in value, and they've paid off some of their debt. And so, you know, in terms of a total net worth statement, assets minus liabilities equals net worth, you know, this should be about 10 times ahead.
But now that's quadrupled.
It's 47 times,
yeah.
Almost quintupled.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. The additional statistic we throw in this week is that 37% of young households have either zero or negative net worth.
That's a hard way to start. Right when you get out of college or right when you get married, and you've got a negative net worth to start with.
And again, you're just taking your assets minus liabilities, and that's your net worth.
Right.
So, Kevin, yeah, that's exactly right. College debt, and in some instances even mortgage debt, are strapping this younger generation with a burden that many older generations never knew.
Right. Well, David, that's also a period of time when we're looking back. There were eras when debt was not as cheap and as accessible as it has been over the last decade or so. Right now, you could get any debt for anything at almost any price.
Well, I think the other thing is that older set went to college when tuition, relative to the average income at the time, was not as inflated.
Right.
And so that's the issue, Kevin. You've got an inflation in education, thus an increase in the total stock of debt that a young couple is carrying, one or two if they're both college educated, and a first-time home purchase, which was not done in sort of nosebleed territory in terms of pricing.
Right.
So that's been the experience of anyone buying a house in the last 10 years. These have been the peak prices. So you've paid very high prices, which have now depreciated, plus you're sitting on an outstanding stock of debt, was supposed to propel you forward professionally and give you greater opportunities. And yet you can't get past that negative net worth number.
Well, and getting past a negative net worth number can happen if you have a job. But, I mean, unemployment right now is a huge, huge problem with the youth as well.
A teenage unemployment's at the highest level since the Great Depression. It's slightly better than it was in 2009 when it peaked at about 27%. And, of course, the employment prospects remain better for the college-educated set. But listen, that doesn't mean it's easy.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that when you get a job, it's at the number that you thought it was. I remember interviewing a young man out in Southern California. This is about 5 years ago. He's a graduating senior at a private institution. And he just looks at me very calmly and with a bit of swagger in his voice, says, "Oh, I would expect $125,000 start, and who knows what the bonus would be on top of that." And I'm thinking to myself, who are you? What world do you exist in? I've looked at your resume. You have zero experience. The fact that you're just now graduating with a four-year college degree, someone has spent far too much time patting you on the back in considering you to be the privileged and the best and the brightest. I'm seeing an interesting resume, but not one that's compelling to the tune of $125,000 a year as a starting salary.
Well,
excuse me.
And that kind of salary actually would pay back college debt pretty quick. I mean, most of these guys graduate with a pretty strong average debt, don't they?
At least $22,000 to $28,000 is sitting there. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure where that statistic comes from, because everyone that I know carries a debt of $45,000 to $60,000 if they've done master's degrees or have gone to college and specialized in something sort of postgraduate. Yeah, now you're talking $100,000, $200,000, $250,000. I know many people in their 40s who still have $120,000, $130,000 in debt because they did sort of a professional career advancement beyond undergrad.
Well, and Dave, do you think because this money has been so easily available for that kind of thing, is that why tuition has risen so quickly? I mean, tuition is the one thing that if you were to measure from an inflation index, it'd scare you to death.
Tuition's up 440% over the last 25 years. Kevin, college and university study has become big business, and it's not so much the quality of education as it is the quantity of students through the door. How many butts can we put in the seat? Because that's the revenue that we're going to generate on a per-year basis.
But are they improving their critical thinking skills? Are they able to actually change direction when they need to? Or are they just coming out in that one field?
Now, Mark Faber, in a recent report, was pointing to a study done by New York University and the University of Virginia, and what they were coming up with is that while you have more people getting degrees, that they were finding at least one-third of all college students graduating had no improvement in critical thinking skills, no improvement in analytical reasoning, and no improvement in writing and communication skills. Kevin, what's the point? What's the point? I mean, Kevin, this is like the 16 tons and what do you get?
Right. Another day older and deeper in debt.
Even if you're just getting out of college, it would seem. So youth unemployment continues to increase. But, Kevin, this is real interesting. For anyone who knows someone in their 18 to sort of 25-year-old range, there's a new sense of aimlessness, Kevin, and a new sort of purposelessness. I don't know if it's the additional burden of debt. I don't know what it is exactly, Kevin. I certainly view this class coming out, graduating class, as graduating as serfs, frankly, forced to deal with now a conflicting view of themselves, the super special children of super special people, and yet nobody wants to hire them.
Right.
Which doesn't seem to be consistent. I thought I was super special. Everyone's always patted me on the back and told me that I just need to study something that I enjoy so that I can have a job that I'm deeply fulfilled in, and nobody thinks to seem I'm that special. Nobody's offering me a job.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Well, and Dave, I wonder, too, this is a generation that was raised on video games and things where you got enough golden rings to go to the next level, and then you did this, and you went to the next level, you know, like a Donkey Kong generation, where you know that if you just do the correct things, and in this case, let's say, go to college,
get
a degree.
You get to go to the next level.
You get the next level, yeah.
Well, we wonder what kind of voter is being created through these circumstances. Is it someone who has sort of a skeptical eye to all authority because they feel like they were misled somewhere along the way, and perhaps the dream of being college educated and launching and having a life of quote-unquote significance on that basis isn't really a dream at all? It's turning into a nightmare for them. Is it, on the other hand, the type of person who's going to be open to sort of grand governmental solutions as they look and say, you know, the market... This is what we were taught in our very left-leaning college classes. The market has abused us, and government is the only solution. we think there's going to be a certain sort of openness, Kevin, amongst this new generation, and we just wonder what is going to fill that void.
Well, you know, David, it's amazing when I talk to people. We live in a college town here. Durango, Colorado is a college town, and when I ask at the coffee shops, what's your major, it's almost overwhelming. It has a green leaning. It's some sort of environmental study or ecology, or, and I think about it, and I'm thinking, golly, I don't know anybody who actually is studying how to produce something. It's just really how to save the earth.
Well, and there's no problem with that. I think that's laudable, except that all the funding for most of those programs comes from government grants.
Right.
So your assumption in your professional career choice is that the government's going to spend the money to get this project going. And that's probably where the fly is deeply in the ointment.
Well, David, for those, and again, this is not an indictment on anybody who's from 18 to 24 or 25. If you're industrious, if you're flexible, if you're educating yourself and interested, you know, they say to be interesting, you need to be interested. And there are a lot of people out there. There are people who are listening to the program right now who are very interested, and they are going to get into the job market. But there is a major concern right now. Even those who are employed, who are engaged, the wages are lower, David.
Kevin, we're certainly interested in social commentary and trying to figure out what the world looks like from a qualitative standpoint for us. There's some quantitative elements here which we're also interested in because they drive us towards where we think the equity markets may be in coming years and what may in fact be a reasonable investment thesis, not just for the next 6 months, but for the next 6 or 60 years. Are there significant trends that are taking place that will mark this generation and mark this generation's investment thematics and investment choices? Kevin, that brings us back around to this issue of students today, because we think they're going to be less inclined to be the robust consumers of tomorrow. Many of them are, in fact, critical of past generations for being overconsumptive.
Right.
And as you said, Kevin, they do have a sort of green leaning, and maybe that's coming from an educational bias, but they're seeing lots of people with lots of stuff and not a lot of happiness.
Right.
And a part of that is because a lot of that stuff people don't actually own outright, and they do have it, but only because the loan was there and the money was cheap.
So there is a positive twist to this. If a person starts to see, wait a second, the world isn't all about just buying the next iPod, it doesn't come with the almighty dollar.
Well, exactly. And then that period of 66 to 82, Kevin, was a period where people were saying, you know, I don't think I need as much.
Right.
I'm going to save more. You know, I'm going to be smart about tomorrow. I'm gravely concerned about what I see in the world today. And if I'm going to take care of my own family someday, then I know I need to be making wise choices now.
But David, if I went backwards in a time machine right now to 1966 and knew what the stock market was going to look like from 66 to 82, you can bet I wouldn't be in the stock market.
Right. That's a major concern for us, Kevin, because you've got low wages, you've got consumption and the impact of these declining trends on corporate profits. That's been the story and will continue to be the story for the next 5 to 10 years. Labor compensation, according to Morgan Stanley economist Gerard Minnick, is at its lowest levels in 50 years compared to GDP. So labor compensation is on the decline, right, while consumption has been on the rise. What has filled the gap, Kevin? Comparing consumer outlays to labor income, that the real divergence began back in 1970. We actually did begin to see a shift then, which really got into full gear in 1980, 1982.
Well, I just want to insert this, David, before you go on, because what happened in 1971, August 15th, was the dollar went off of the gold standard. And so monetary discipline went out the window at about the same time that you start to see this increase of public spending.
And about 10 years later, you saw a massive change in general sentiment and rapid acceleration in consumer spending, which coincided with a change in interest rate trends right around 1980.
Right.
Exactly. So since then, even as wages have been declining, consumption, as I mentioned, has been on the increase. What's the gap been filled by?
It's debt. It's just pure debt.
Cheaper and cheaper rates and on easier terms. So, Kevin, if that's been the story, is it safe for us as investors to assume that the drivers of the market of yesterday are necessarily the drivers of the market of tomorrow? And we would contend that no, we will have different drivers. And in fact, some of the things that have been there to prop and to fuel the market growth of yesterday simply are absent today.
So, David, this newer generation that's going to be fueling whatever markets are out there, they're not going to be able to take debt like we've seen in the past. And they're actually going to be experiencing the deleveraging of old debt. We talked about old debts having to roll over and new debts having to be taken out. Well, you can't have the new debt if the old debt can't get paid.
Yeah, and sometimes people forget that deleveraging is just a big word for paying down debt.
Right.
And then an increase in savings is likely to occur amongst this generation gradually beginning to see improvement in the national savings rate as we speak. And that should be thought of in a future tense where the GDP growth dynamics of the last several decades are not being repeated. Because, again, the Keynesian model impresses upon human consciousness, spend, spend, spend. Thrift is for fools.
Right.
And thrift and savings are reemerging, Kevin. And I think long-term that's very positive, but short-term that does mean a contraction in margins for corporations. It does mean a slowdown in sales. It does mean a shrinkage in earnings. And, Kevin, that does mean something very tangible for someone who's investing in equities today.
Well, David, this is just the revisiting of the true business cycle. I mean, yes, it's grand and it's larger. I mean, these huge 30-year cycles, one direction or another, are caused by Keynesian economics. But you still have the contraction healing the economy. It just takes almost an entire adult lifetime for it to happen.
Well, if the consumer is less of a driver of economic growth for years and perhaps even decades to come, that begs the question, will government spending and will deficit spending be used to make up the difference in future years as we've seen it done here in recent years, Kevin?
Right.
This is the critical point, because if this is in fact the case, Kevin, we will have a date with destiny very similar to that of the European debt crisis last week, the week before, and in coming weeks, in coming months in Europe. This will be coming to a theater near you.
Where the market basically says it's unsustainable.
The growth was unsustainable, can't do it, can't be done on the basis of debt, and there weren't enough savings to draw down from. The good news is that as the consumer does enter an age of thrift and savings, you are setting up the stockpile for growth and investment and a period of expansion in the business cycle in the future.
Right, but that's a long time in the future. Let me ask you about earnings for companies, David, because if indeed consumption's going to drop and if there's less money available coming up in this next generation, what happens to corporate profits?
That's where they do get eroded. And I think, you know, this goes back to Jeremy Grantham's comments we mentioned last week, where he says this is probably the peak in the earnings cycle. And here's the interesting thing he didn't say, but you should connect. If this is the peak in the earnings cycle, then this is probably the peak in the pricing cycle as far as equities are concerned.
Well, last week, David, you said this next year you really do expect several thousand points to come off of the stock market, you know, barring some unforeseen huge, you know, infusion of cash or what have you from the government. Well, David, what we're talking about here sounds pretty dire for the market, but we're talking about the United States market. I know a lot of people right now have been focusing on the emerging markets. They've been focusing on China. You know, the attitude is the United States maybe, well, the United States and Europe may have their problems, but we also have this mentality that the emerging markets and China are going to be some sort of savior. Is that something that you can see happening?
Kevin, I think one of the things that's missing today amongst investors, amongst people in general, is the patience requisite to be a successful investor.
Right.
And you want to see something happen now. And there is so much opportunity over the next 5 to 25 years. You just can't expect to be rewarded in the next 5 minutes.
Right.
And yet that's what we're used to, Kevin. We have become, I don't know how, but we've become like rats in the cage. If we can just tap the button and get the stimulus, tap the button and get the stimulus, tap the button and get the stimulus.
It's that video game mentality.
We're happy, happy, yeah, happy, unless
right,
we're sad, sad, sad. And we don't have a time frame. We don't have a patience scape, if you will, that would include what is happening now and its implications over the next 2, 3, 5, 7, 10 years.
Right.
If these things are the case, don't worry. Don't rush it. If you are rushing issues, you're going to find yourself in an awkward position. What you just raised, Kevin, is a very interesting issue in terms of the emerging markets and the myth that they're going to carry the day. Going back again to Grantham's comments, you remember the younger generation coming of age. Low wages, low credit access, that's the environment we're in. Many are already loaded with debt and simply unable to contribute to GDP growth as past generations have. You know, in a long enough time frame, the good news is that we're talking about a new era of thrift.
Right.
Even better news is that this prepares the investment world for fresh capital, non-leverage, and it allows for a period of capital scarcity, which drives marginal businesses out. You will see business failure, and that's not a bad thing.
Well, and David, you know, the whole investment strategy of buying low and selling high, unless things are allowed to fall to the low, you can't ever get that low. And so the very best business cycles or the very best investments that have ever played themselves out were purchased during these periods of time.
There's a healthy evolutionary process embedded in the business cycle where bad ideas fail and good ideas get to continue. So the strong survive.
Right.
And Kevin, we would like to own the strong companies that have survived. We'd like to get through the period of time, most like the 66 to 82 period of low growth rates, high levels of savings, and emerge again into an environment where savings, which are and will continue to be set aside, get deployed into value investments. And again, by the time we get there, and is this 2 years from now or is this 12 years from now? We don't know.
For now, what do you see in the market? Are you thinking it's just going to be lethargic? You had mentioned that you thought we would see the stock market come down. That's not set in stone, but you don't see great gains in equities for at least the near term.
No, I don't see anything fundamentally driving the market higher. So what you have driving the market higher is what we had last week. Tuesday, you've got close to a 300-point move. Wednesday, close to 500 points, 490 points up on the Dow. Kevin, this was liquidity-driven. Somebody had insider information. Okay, so in case you think you're playing on an even playing field, understand that certain people sleep with other people, or certain people pay other people, or certain people dine with other people. And that may even be Goldman Sachs employees sleeping, paying, and eating with Fed Treasury officials. Kevin, this is fascinating, a fascinating period in time. So just wait around for QE 3, 4, 5, and guess what you have? A reason for equity values to move higher. Is that something that is ultimately going to be rewarding for the long-term investor? We would argue no. And I just want to come back to your issue of the emerging market myth.
Yeah, Dave, the subject of emerging markets. There's a lot of people, and you know, we joke about it because your dad likes to play with you on this one because he really likes China. But are the emerging markets going to pull this one out?
Are they going to carry the weight of the world on their shoulders? Kevin, you've got real credit growth in China, which is collapsing. You've got the real estate market in China, which is imploding. You've got banks, although they're state-controlled, they're still in trouble. Being state-controlled just means that they have more control over the information flow, and they can obscure things much more conveniently. So they can go further down the road, but I would say they're going down the road limping along more and more as they go. The modern central bank panacea, Kevin, of money printing may in fact keep the gears churning within the emerging markets, but only with weaker currencies. Kevin, you're really talking about the cost of growth in the emerging markets being seen and felt in the form of higher inflation.
Well, yeah, inflation is, when somebody says weak currency, that's sort of a euphemism for costing more, a weak currency.
Well, exactly. So lest we forget, rising inflation in developing countries is very destabilizing. So the choice to print and print and print, it has a very different and unsettling effect in places of the world where you're sort of on edge in terms of whether or not you can or cannot feed your family to begin with.
Well, David, I know a lot of times people say, well, I don't like the U.S. stock market, so I'm going to go to another market because maybe it's going to perform differently. And I think that may be a misunderstanding because equities oftentimes correlate with each other very closely, don't they?
Well, and Kevin, that's the issue. There is some degree of correlation, and Société Générale did a great study on this, but there's always some degree of equity market correlation. What is unique is that you can normally expect there to be sort of a one standard deviation, either more correlation or less correlation, and you know, somewhere between 40 and 60% is normal.
Right.
Now we're consistently trading with global equity markets, trading in lockstep at about an 80 to 85% correlation.
So in other words, when the stock market here in the United States or in Europe goes down, you can pretty much count on the Asian market 85% of the time going down.
It's going to be marginally better or marginally worse, but they're moving in lockstep. 100% correlation would be spot on, basically the same market. We're not saying that's the case. They are different, but you're only talking about a 15% variance in terms of the actual numbers to where they are moving in the same direction at the same times.
Well, David, last week your level of concern for the European markets and our markets was at almost a peak. And then of course, the 357 euro bailout came in, you know, whatever you want to call it, the swap lines, what have you. And it papered over it temporarily. But you've mentioned some things to the guys here, talking very personally, not necessarily about clients, but just to these guys saying, look, this is the year. If there's going to be a Christmas time when you're with family, friends, what have you, and they're confused and they're concerned, this is the time to pull the napkin out, draw the triangle, and just show them the simple solution. It's not like it's a magic solution, but it definitely is something that can be simply stated. Even a child would understand, but most people don't do.
When you're with aunts and uncles, when you're with brothers and sisters, when you're with distant relatives, I think this is the time to definitely pull out the napkin, Kevin, and say, listen, this is real simple, but it's one of the reasons why I come into the holiday season without the same stress and strain I'm hearing in your voice.
Right.
And here's why. So over a glass of eggnog or mulled wine, just explain it as simply as possible. You've got the base of the triangle, you've got the sides of the triangle, and they're performing mandates. This has to do with the expectations that you have, the requirements that you're putting on, the asset base that you have. You take your liquid assets and you say, okay, I have to maintain my household.
Right.
I have to pay bills. I have to continue to look for opportunities, manage a business in addition to managing a household in some instances, and therefore that right side of the perspective triangle is given to liquidity.
Right.
Kevin, I was reminded of how important this liquidity function is, spending time with dear friends down in the Houston area for Thanksgiving.
Right.
And this is a company that is thriving. It's doing quite well, but there's not enough liquidity to even make payroll.
So they're doing well, but they don't have enough actual cash to pay the bills.
And a part of it is because they're doing more and more business and the terms of settlement on each transaction they have is 60, 90, 120 days, they're having to do all the work on their nickel. And yes, they're happy for more business, but as they've done more business, it's deleted their cash and they don't have the liquidity to operate. So this is my point, Kevin. Whether it's a household or a business, don't neglect the liquidity side of the perspective triangle. On the left-hand side of the triangle, again, we're talking about the mandates that you give them, not the specific things that you invest in,
right,
but the theoretical requirements that you put on them. So liquidity is there just to be available,
to
be liquid.
Right side. The right side, and then the left side is the growth side.
Growth or income. And you're talking about stocks and bonds. Again, I'm not going to give you the specifics here, but you can have an equity or a securities exposure there, and its mandate is growth and income.
Right.
The bottom part of the triangle is insurance.
That's the gold.
Someone may have more silver than gold, more gold than silver, more platinum and palladium. I don't care what's at the base as long as you're very clear on the mandates that you're giving your assets.
Well, and that's physical holding of that particular item, something that you're not really looking for a paper contract saying that you have.
No, because now you're introducing other elements of risk and you wouldn't want to compromise the strength and the surety of that insurance.
With that side, no one's ever gone broke with an ounce of gold.
Well, and this is why you look at this combination and you say, again, back of the napkin. I like the fact that whether it's an inflationary outcome, I have the base covered.
Right.
I like the fact that if it's a deflationary outcome and the debt unwind, the deleveraging, which we may see part or total here or overseas, I'm covered. I have that liquid portion. And I like the fact that if I'm taken by surprise and somehow a rabbit's pulled out of the hat and we do find ourselves in the middle of a growth cycle again, I have a third of my assets which are able, like the sail, to collect the wind and be empowered. I have an opportunity and I have protection all in one by taking this balanced approach. The critical part is this, Kevin. Too many people are not engaged. Too many people have trusted their financial advisors to come to the table with all the answers. And I'm sorry, there's very few financial advisors who are even asking the right questions, let alone have the right answers. And so what we find in talking with clients is that they generally are more curious than their own financial advisors, doing more homework than their own financial advisors. And this is why you're coming up with consternation, concern, bordering on the paranoid, where people are saying, I just don't think my bases are covered. I've been told over and over and over again, just don't buy gold. Do anything else, but don't buy gold. That's the general stock advice that you get from Wall Street.
So, David, indeed, a person should be able to draw this for anybody and explain this to anybody, and maybe it will, this holiday season, ease some tension and actually help a person long term.
Well, Kevin, I think when you look at how simple this is, it obviously is not complex enough to include every decision that you make as a financial person, entity, business, family, what have you. But it gives you the simplicity that you need to organize your thoughts, to organize your assets, to organize the mandates, and to be able to categorize and then move from one to the other and determine whether or not you're making good decisions for that section of your asset base. Kevin, it's that idea of moving from simplicity to complexity and then back to simplicity that we find a very healthy way of approaching your finances. And this is the reality. When you sit down with your kids and grandkids, it needs to be boiled down to something that can fit on the back of a napkin. When you're trying to teach a life lesson and say, here's what I'd like for you to keep in mind, This is the way I handle my own finances. And obviously there's more detail than I can share, but I want you to think in these terms because there has to be a balanced approach. You have to take humility into account when you're managing money. And as you're given more responsibility by your grandmother, as you're sort of passing money intergenerationally, here's some principles we want for you to keep in mind. And it begins with what we call our perspective triangle. It's the way we manage our risk. It's the way we look forward to opportunity. And it's the way that the next generation, we'd like for you to see that.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.